Some nights, in canyons of restless sleep, Carson sought the satisfaction of bloody vengeance, scenarios in which he prowled mean streets, as though he were Denzel Washington in an Equalizer movie, found the shooter by dream logic, and cut him down dead. However, he had zero expectation of justice in the waking world. 4 years ago, having moved from an elected coroner system to the establishment of a medical examiner's office, Pinehaven County had hired Carson from a wide field of applicants. His task had been not merely to do professional forensic autopsies, the discoveries of which would stand up in court, but also to establish an adequate crime lab that would free the sheriff's department from the need to farm out aspects of its investigations to state-level authorities. The county's coroners had nearly always been retired doctors or active morticians who did their best, although none of them had sufficient training to understand the precise procedures necessary to avoid contaminating evidence derived from an autopsy. During his first year on the job, Carson worked 80-hour weeks and thrived on the schedule, which allowed him the forgetting that he sought. Year by year he remained busy, but he settled into his position with confidence and pleasure. Born and raised a city boy and black, he had expected that adjustment to this rustic environment would be taxing, to say the least, but it was smooth beyond all expectation. He enjoyed the modest scale of life here, the majesty of the Sierra Nevada, the natural beauty. He loved that deer sometimes wandered along Main Street as if they were tourists who were curious about the ways of Pinehaven's inhabitants. Loved even the nasty but industrious raccoons that worked assiduously to defeat each new and more complex latch that he installed on the lids of his trash cans. The people were not as he'd been warned to expect. For 40 years or longer, in most of the country, there'd been a sophistication and fair-mindedness in rural counties and small towns about which many city dwellers and members of the media seemed clueless. Carson was happy here, charmed by the quiet flow of events, grateful to be free from the metropolitan bustle that made life a competitive marathon race without end. In the past year or so, a disquieting change had come slowly to Pinehaven County. Occasional outriders from MS-13 and other Central American gangs, scouting for opportunities like remote and easily concealed locations for meth labs, checking out the strength and determination of local law enforcement. There had been incidents between them and a few deputies, nothing too alarming. But a pretty teenager, Jenna McCall, had vanished without a trace. She'd been a good student, a devoted daughter, not the kind of girl who opted to be a runaway. And Jimmy Talbert, 13, had been riding his bike on an unpaved Forest Service road when he'd been struck by a hit-and-run driver and left to bleed to death. There hadn't been a case of hit-and-run in Pinehaven County in 36 years. So everyone had suspicions informed by common sense. Carson Conroy's suspicions and fears failed to prepare him for the condition of Justine Kleinman's corpse. The morgue had two autopsy tables, each with scales and sink, and the woman's companion, Paynton Spader, occupied the first. He'd been shot 4 times, point-blank, with hollow-point rounds. The devastation to flesh and bone were only what could be expected. Initially, Carson thought that Justine had likewise been shot, and that wild animals, perhaps coyotes, had savaged her after she'd been left for dead. When he could not find a bullet wound, he looked for evidence of knife work, but he found none. Her skull remained intact. No blunt instrument had put her down. Only when the likeliest of weapons had been ruled out did he, of necessity, look more closely at her face. Little was left of it. She might have been a beauty once, but there was no way to know from these remains. Most of her face had been eaten, as had one of her breasts and part of the other. Carson had seen many gruesome things in his profession, and the horrors to which victims were vulnerable had long ago ceased to chill him. However, a chill climbed his spine now and fluttered through him like some insect horde. The bite marks along the perimeter of the remaining tissue were not those of an animal. They had the curvature and tooth pattern of the human mouth. Chapter 37. By the time Megan read 3 chapters of the novel and finished the glass of Cabernet, Woody had still not appeared in the kitchen. When he seemed to have difficulty returning from one of his deeper retreats, she could sometimes encourage him with music. He liked to listen to her play the Steinway and always watched her as if amazed that she could conjure music from its keys. Sometimes she left a handwritten note for him. A recent one had asked, "Would you like me to teach you to play the piano?" He never answered that one, or any of the others, but she hoped one day he might. Exchanging notes would not be the same as two-way speech, but it would be a more satisfying form of communication than she'd yet enjoyed with him. She went along the main hallway to the living room and turned on the lights. At the piano, Megan halted, at the sight of all the silver-framed photographs, lying face down on the lid. Verna Brickett polished the silver and glass once a week, but she'd never before left the photographs like this. Nor would she. Verna was meticulous almost to the point of obsession. Woody must have done this. But why? The obvious answer seemed to be that the sight of his father in all those photos had suddenly pierced him. After 3 years, she'd thought he had accommodated himself to the loss, but evidently not as much as she'd believed. He was a genius, and people tended to think that geniuses were less emotional than other people, but she knew this was not true of him. He felt things profoundly. Sometimes she wondered if he remained silent because he feared that, if he dared to speak, his long-repressed emotions would erupt with volcanic power, that he would be unable to control them and would say things that would shock by the very rawness of the passion with which he said them. She left the framed photos as they were and didn't raise the piano lid. She would ask him about the pictures later. She sat on the bench and put up the fallboard, uncovering the keys, flexed her fingers. The dozen or so songs Woody liked the most, each of which he could listen to over and over for hours, were a varied catalog. While the words had meaning for him, Megan suspected that the melodies were what spoke the most directly to his soul. After considering choices, she played Moon River, and that beautiful melody, drenched in yearning and gentle melancholy, flowed through the living room and into the hall and up the stairs, perhaps to call the boy out of the shell in which he had closed himself. Chapter 38. In the vividly imagined high redoubt of Castle Wyvern, lying on a bed of reeds, Woody stared at the glassless panes of the southern window, which was where the sign always appeared, the bluebird or the soft-furred white rat, to certify that he'd suffered enough for his errors. Iron-dark clouds scudded fast across the sky. Waves of lightning throbbed through those curdled masses without thunder, the forces of these heavens as silent as the boy who conceived them. If he'd done even worse than he thought, if he'd drawn the murderers out of the dark web and all the way here to Pinehaven, if they were even now in transit, no amount of penance could earn forgiveness or safety, and he would be condemned to this tower room forever. Then a sound came that he'd never heard before, a curious whine, followed by a sigh and a series of heart-wrenching whimpers. When he lowered his gaze from the southern window to the floor, he saw a golden retriever curled in a ball and sleeping, whimpering because it was caught in a bad or perhaps sorrowful dream. Nothing like this had ever happened before, and Woody didn't know what to make of it. Might the dog be a sign, like the bluebird and the white rat, a sign that he had atoned for the mess he'd made and could now leave the castle to rejoin his mother in their cozy house? While that question remained unanswered, an unseen presence spoke to him, the disconnected words whispering along the stone walls of the tower.
"Smile for Dorothy, dear sweet Kip, my special boy, my mystery, Mysterium."
Woody sat up on the thick bed of reeds and surveyed the chamber, where shadows hung that, with each pulse of lightning, billowed as draperies would when disturbed by a draft. The speaker, a woman, remained invisible. A harder, scary male voice was almost a snarl.
"I know. Your kind. Teach you. A lesson."
3 oil-burning sconces flamed and smoked where none had been, because he willed it so, and in the dancing light no other presence but the dog revealed itself. A 3rd voice, another man.
"Never, never hit a dog. Clover, cancer, eating her alive, the hardest thing."
And now all 3 voices issued forth.
"Teach you a lesson.
Cancer, Clover, Dorothy, my Kip, my special boy, my special boy."
The oil-fired sconces ceased to exist, and shadows stirred by the stormlight shivered into the room. Woody rose to his feet as the sleeping dog became as transparent as golden glass and then vanished. Somewhere a piano played Moon River. As surely as Castle Wyvern was of Woody's creation, so were the bluebird and the white rat that came as signs to free him from his self-imposed isolation. He knew this. The bird and the rat were expressions of his conscience when he felt that he had done enough penance for his offenses. And he knew as well that the beautiful dog was definitely not his invention, that it had been inserted into his fantasy by someone else. The voices had not been his, and the words had not originated with him. He didn't understand how that could be or what it portended, but it seemed to him that this was the first real sign that he had ever received. A gladness overcame him, and he was greatly relieved of his fear that denizens of the dark web would find him and his mother. He didn't need to throw open the massive bolts in the door of the High Redoubt, did not need to descend the tower stairs and make his way through the inner ward and raise the portcullis and exit the inner gate. He merely turned in a full circle, and in his turning, the medieval chamber became his modern room, where he stood beside a bed not made of reeds. The familiar haunting melody rose from the piano downstairs, and as always, it spoke to him of all the things he would never do. He would never travel as free as a flowing river, would never be crossing it in style some day. He would never be off to see the world, because the world in its immensity and complexity was too much for him. Although the lovely melody encircled Woody as surely as did the fence of his autism, he didn't find it to be a sad song. Quite the contrary. The song endorsed the value of dreaming of doing things when actually doing them wasn't possible, and for all of his limitations, Woody was a dreamer of the highest order. He crossed the room and opened the door and stepped into the upstairs hall, where the music called him back to a world he knew and with which he could cope most of the time, to the house in the pines and the mother whose graceful hands made beauty from all that she touched. Chapter 39. Although Shacket does not intend to sleep in Megan's bed, the sensorial treasure that she imparted to the sheets merely by lying between them overwhelms his increasingly acute senses. An intensely fragrant, erotic sachet that inspires vivid visions of the bitch's naked form, that are arousing and yet strangely soporific. Though at first awake, he is floating in a sea of lascivious images, like a pubescent boy swept into a dream that will end in a night emission. The swell of full young breasts, smooth, thrusting buttocks, silken limbs encircling him, a thrilling suffocation of flesh. He can smell the particles of skin she's shed in sleep, the moistness that her labia imparted to the cotton during her dreams of gratification, the faint traces of colostrum that, though she is not pregnant, have for some reason leaked from her nipples, as if she has anticipated him, and is readying herself to feed him as her own. He can smell the place on her pillow where, in sleep, a thread of drool has unraveled from a corner of her ripe lips, and he works the luxurious fabric with his tongue to lick up the taste of her mouth. In his fantasies, her elegant hands caress her curvaceous body, offering its pleasures to him. He wants to suck her fingers, lick the delicate webs between them, and bite the thinner eminence, the plump ball of the thumb. His senses are sodden with lust, so he cannot think, and the sensory overload, this incogitant drowning in sensation, is a kind of sedation that sends him sinking into sleep, as whiskey might a dizzy drunkard. His dreams run like any he has had before. A wildness informs them, an almost frantic sense that anything is possible, that just ahead lies some revelation that will satisfy his every need and put an end forever to all his fears. Urgently he races through a gothic forest, and then across a moonlit meadow, in a body other than his own, four-legged and quicker than a man, his breath steaming from him in a night coldness that he can't feel because he is hot-blooded and burning with exertion. He is with others of his kind, lean and long-limbed and sharp-toothed beasts, and when they glimpse the lame and hobbling deer, there's a howling that is a celebration to them, but horrifying to the gentle object of their passion. At this peak of excitement, the dream morphs. He morphs, and no longer understands what he is or knows what he wants, only that he must feed. He is something that crawls and scuttles in a blinding dark, consuming filth, something that is driven by a mindless agitation to which the slightest draft is a threat, and sudden light sends them into frenetic flight, into crevice and hole and descending rot. And he finds himself now something else altogether, drowned and yet alive, creeping across the floor of an ocean under tremendous pressure that would kill a man, far below the reach of the warm sun, where phosphorescent plants weave tentacles of eerie light. Through the fathoms comes a familiar music that draws him toward wakefulness. As he ascends, he understands that these dreams were shaped not out of the ordinary experiences of life, but perhaps issued from genetic memories, installed by whatever DNA billions of archaea have carried with them when he inhaled them in Springville, Utah. He wakes. From below issues Moon River, which irritates Shackett in the same way that the painting in Megan's studio irritated him. Both her art and this song are too soft, too richly layered with the useless emotions that cloud the mind and prevent a recognition of the truth that life is hard and dark and meaningless. Life is about nothing but desire and its fulfillment, hunger and its satisfaction, hatred and the violence that it requires. It's about the power to take what you want by any means necessary. Theft, rape, and killing are no less natural to humankind than breathing. They are the essential serum of the species, and in Shackett, that serum will achieve a purity heretofore unseen. He turns back the covers and sits on the edge of the bed. He slips his feet into his shoes and ties the laces. He picks up the pistol he left on the nightstand and crosses the room to the door. Chapter 40. Woody stepped into the living room, and Megan's heart lifted at the sight of him. When he came to the piano, she hoped that he might have recovered from his sorrow sufficiently to put right at least a few of the photographs of his father that he'd overturned. However, though she gave him Moon River yet again from the top, he only stood listening, with a dreamy expression. When she finished playing and quietly closed the fallboard, she said, "Honey, why did you turn these photographs face down?" The boy turned his attention to the toppled frames and frowned. "You still miss your dad, I know. I miss him, too, very much. I always will. He was the best man I've ever known." Woody looked at her, still frowning, but she could read nothing in his face or eyes. "Putting away pictures of him won't also put away the painful memories. Keeping your dad in our lives with pictures and memories, keeping him in our hearts, where we never really lose him, that's the best way to come to terms with what happened. Do you understand, sweetie?" Still frowning, the boy nodded. As she suggested that they set the photographs upright together, he left the living room. There would be no point in calling him back. He was neither thoughtless nor disobedient, merely a prisoner of his condition, impelled to act according to an interpretation of the moment and the circumstances that was logical to him, but beyond her understanding. Very likely after they ate dinner, as Megan cleared the table, Woody would return to the living room on his own, and would set all the silver frames upright, the meaning of her request having been received by him as if her words were in a foreign language and required laborious translation. Such delayed compliance to a request was not unusual. She followed him along the main hallway to the kitchen. He went to the table and settled in the chair where she'd been sitting, and picked up the novel she'd been reading. Careful not to displace her bookmark, he began reading from page one. The book had nothing in it that she would wish to censor from him, so she said only, "It'll be a late dinner now, but a good one." Before she retrieved the sliced carrots and cauliflower from the refrigerator, potted them, and spiced them for cooking, she decanted a second glass of Cabernet. For Woody, she poured grape-raspberry-flavored sparkling ice. She served it to him in a wine glass, just like hers. Chapter 41. Shackett stands at the head of the stairs, his back against the hallway wall, so that he is gazing down into the foyer as the boy and then his delectable mother exit the living room. Having heard their one-sided conversation, he wonders if the woman suffers her son's mental disability in a milder form. It makes no sense to talk to a mute with half a brain as though he understands and might at any moment respond, when in fact he's never spoken a word in his stunted life. And the soft creak-thump of the swinging door signals that they have entered the kitchen. Shacket quickly descends the stairs to the foyer with a cat-like silence that inspires a Cheshire grin. His becoming thrills him. The subtle smell of her wet vagina, which trails after her, is a promise that floods his mouth with saliva. He licks a modest overflow from the corners of his lips. In the living room, his smile fades as he recalls what she'd said to the boy. All that treacly crap about Jason. One line in particular incenses Shacket. "He was the best man I've ever known." The slut has probably known countless men, but she's never known Lee Shacket. Not really known him. She's never let him through her gate, never given him the chance to prove that he's able to satisfy her as no other man ever could. That will soon change. At the Steinway, he considers the silver frames. He picks one up, turns it over, and stares at Megan and Jason. The prize and the thief who stole it. The hot bitch and the treacherous bastard. His first impulse is to throw the photograph to the floor, stamp hard on it, smash the glass that protects it, shatter all of her treasured memories just as she and her treacherous husband shattered Shackett's hopes. But she will hear. She will come to investigate. And this is not the place or the time that he wishes to impose the future he intends for her. Having been in her bed and previewed, in fantasies, the pleasures of her, he is intent on easing between the sheets as she sleeps, waking her by taking her. In the dark of her bedroom, while in her blindness she wonders who has mounted her and filled her as never before, he will watch with his mothy vision as Megan's shock and fright quickly give way to rapture, her long, shapely legs encircling him to pull him deeper. Archaea isn't a bacteria, and the changes those billions have brought and are still bringing to him can't be passed like influenza. If the new genetic information that has been installed in him is in his sperm, however, he'll impregnate her with a child who will be as superior to other children as Lee Shacket is now superior to all other men. Instead of smashing the glass in the photograph, he pries up the tabs on the frame, removes the thin cardboard backing, and extracts the picture. One by one, he removes the 9 photos from the other frames. His intention is to tuck them between the ceramic logs in the gas fireplace, where eventually he will burn them. But he decides to keep them for a better purpose. He folds them and tucks them in a hip pocket of his jeans. In the night, when he settles atop her, if she rejects him, if she fights, if she mocks and demeans him, if she prefers her dead husband and her idiot child to a new life with Shacket, he will knock her senseless, and wad each photograph, and force them down her throat one by one, until she chokes to death on her precious family. Chapter 42. The cold, white, smoky masses surged sluggishly through the night, like the enormous shoulders and haunches of dream beasts that wouldn't quite take form. Judging by all available evidence, the world had vaporized. No trees presented themselves, no structures, no more oncoming traffic. If pavement existed under the tires, Rosa Leon couldn't glimpse it. The vague rectangular shape of what might be a sign was briefly blind-stamped in the murk, but appeared blank, as though no community existed anywhere ahead to be announced in this world dissolving. The headlights smeared an icy glare up the wall of fog, but penetrated it no more than a few feet. From the murk emerged a phantom, casting balls of sputtering red brightness to the ground. Rosa slowed even further, and the figure hurrying toward her clarified, a highway patrol officer laying down flares. A moment later, mysterious nebulae of hazy light swelled in the beclouded night, white and red and blue, diffused beams and blinking points and swiveling pulsing beacons, as though a colossal alien ship had landed on the highway. As she drew to a stop behind a waiting line of vehicles, she saw that all lanes of the highway were blocked by a jackknifed 18-wheeler, a mangled sedan, an SUV turned on its side, police vehicles, and at least one ambulance, all of them floating in the thick mist like the flotsam of a shipwreck on a fog-bound sea. The GPS map on the dashboard screen indicated that she was north of Meeks Bay, south of the town of Tahoma. In clear weather, with the highway unobstructed, She might reach her destination in 20 minutes. Now she would be stalled here for hours. When she checked the Pied Finder service on Dorothy's phone, she saw that Kip was still where he had been in Olympic Village. She considered turning around and driving back to the south end of the lake, across the border into Nevada, along the eastern and northern shores, to reconnect with Highway 89 at Tahoe City, a couple of miles south of Olympic Village. But if the fog was likely to be thinner on the Nevada side, there was no guarantee of that, and because of the casinos over there, traffic would be much heavier. She decided to wait where she was. Maybe the authorities would get the highway cleared sooner than she expected. Maybe Kip was settled in and safe for the night. In spite of her difficult life, she'd never been an anxious person. Adversity was best overcome by positive thinking and hard work. Foreboding, let alone full-blown anxiety, distracted the heart and mind, making progress less likely. However, Kip was the most important responsibility that Rosa had ever been given. His welfare, her sacred duty. If he died, or were cast into a miserable situation from which he could not escape, she would not only have failed him, but also Dorothy, and not just the two of them. If anything bad happened to that remarkable dog, she would have failed. Something else, something larger that eluded definition. She felt almost as if to fail Kip would be to fail humankind as well, and somehow imperil the destiny of the world. She was not given to grandiose notions of her importance, quite the opposite, and yet Kip's fate weighed more heavily on her by the minute. As she waited, run aground in this sea of fog, anxiety tore at her. Chapter 43. When he finished dessert, Woody got up from his chair and came around to his mother's side of the kitchen table and stood next to her, his head bowed, waiting expectantly. He could do nothing more to indicate that he wanted to return to his room. Attending to her like this was his way of saying both thank you and good night. Remaining in her chair, Megan took his right hand, brought it to her lips, and kissed it. She pulled him close and kissed his cheek, his brow. As always, he was unable to return her kisses, emotionally constrained by his condition. But he liked being kissed. She held fast to the hope that a day would come when Woody's storehouse of unspent kisses and unspoken words would spring open, that she would hear him say he loved her, would feel his lips pressed to her cheek. Holding his hand in both of hers, she said, "You're the best boy, sweetie. You know that?" He didn't always indicate that he heard what she said to him. Some days his responses were rare or non-existent. But now he shook his head. "But you are," she insisted. "You really are. You're the best boy that you can be, and I appreciate how hard you try. I love you, Woodrow Eugene Bookman." His embarrassment was palpable. His eyes remained downcast, and he chewed on his lower lip. "You brush your teeth and floss. Only 2 minutes with the Sonicare. No matter how badly you might want to brush for 10 or 20 minutes, only 2. Woody nodded. "I'll stop by later to tuck you in and make sure you're all right." When she let go of his hand, he crossed the kitchen and went through the swinging door, not with the exuberance of a young boy, but with the gravity of a little old man. He was not just a small and vulnerable child imprisoned by his developmental disorder. He was also a prodigy, with a high IQ, and the chains of his condition thwarted his great promise. For the sake of her own well-being, Megan dared not consider the intensity of Woody's frustration. She got up and went to the keypad beside the back door. To allow Woody the freedom of the house, she set the alarm system in the at-home mode, arming the doors and most windows and all the glass break sensors, but not the motion detectors. The upstairs windows, those that were beyond easy reach from the ground or a porch roof, had not been wired. Chapter 44. Woody changed into his pajamas and went into his bathroom and brushed his teeth for precisely 2 minutes. He flossed especially well around those teeth that were secured by transplanted tissue donated by a dead man. No, it hadn't been as spooky as that. The guy hadn't been dead when he made the donation. He made arrangements while he was living. Or maybe his family had authorized the taking of the tissue after the man had died. If the latter was the case, Woody hoped that the donor's family wouldn't show up here someday and want to have their pictures taken with him because their loved one's gums were in his mouth. He didn't know the name of the dead guy, so the family had probably not been given Woody's name. But they could always go to court and try to find out. Courts were unpredictable because judges were people. There were a lot of things in life to worry about, but people were the biggest source of problems, especially when you had a developmental disorder like he did and you found a lot of people embarrassing, and you knew they would find you embarrassing too, if they knew anything about you. Not everyone was simply embarrassing. Some were also scary. The scary ones had a subtle smell. He couldn't describe it, but he could detect it. He'd done some reading on the subject, and he learned that many dogs could smell extreme cases of schizophrenia and homicidal psychopathology. So maybe he had a bit of dog in him. When he was around too many people who wanted to interact with him, whether they were scary or just embarrassing, he wanted to scream and scream until they went away with their hands over their ears. But he couldn't scream any more than he could tell them to leave him alone. So instead he got a killer headache, and he grew so nervous that he couldn't think. Sometimes he was nauseated. His stomach and intestines and everything in his abdomen felt as if it came loose and sloshed around. And he became terrified that he was going to start farting like a machine gun. Nothing was more embarrassing than farting, not even having your dead gum donor's family show up to take pictures with you. After he finished in the bathroom, Woody turned out the light and went into his bedroom and stood staring at his computer. After some deliberation, he got on his hands and knees and crawled into the knee space of his desk and plugged everything in again. The bad men at the tragedy website could not have tracked him, and he was never going back there again. His report, The Son's Revenge, faithfully compiled evidence of monstrous evil, lay on his desk. He'd meant to give it to his mom, but then he'd had an episode and needed to go away to Castle Wyvern. He would put it on the breakfast table first thing in the morning. He thought now of the words that had appeared on his screen when he'd been deep in the dark web. You again. And then, you are not Alexander Gordius. And finally, we will find you. That last one had been a bluff. They couldn't have tracked his signal to source, not after all the precautions he'd taken. Nevertheless, he felt pretty sure that he wouldn't fall asleep right away. He lumped his pillows into a pile and sat up in bed with a novel by Patrick O'Brien, a seafaring adventure set in the 18th century. It was a rousing tale about courage and honor and steadfast loyalty, qualities that Woody admired and believed were important, but that he doubted he would ever possess to any significant degree, considering what a mess he was. One way you learned things, however, was by example, which was the reason he read books like this, in addition to the fact that he loved a rattling good story. For the same reason, that you might become what you read, he avoided novels about vampires, werewolves, and zombies. Chapter 45. After Megan washed and dried the dishes, she indulged in a half glass of wine to follow her first two. She sat at the kitchen table to savor the Cabernet while reading two more chapters of her novel. In these latter hours of the evening, a wind had risen out of the northwest, filling the night with whispers and moans. From time to time, a series of soft thumps on the back porch were not evidence of a prowler, merely one of the rocking chairs as a gust of wind bumped it against the house. And the hanging basket of trailing fuchsia swung back and forth, the friction of chain link on hook raising a creak croak that might have been a hacksaw determinately chewing through something as hard as bone. Noises within the house sometimes suggested the presence of an intruder. Phantom footsteps, the creak of a door. But they were only the usual settling noises, on this occasion exaggerated by the structure's resistance to the wind's insistence. In the weeks immediately following Jason's death, when Megan and Woody moved to these acres on the outskirts of Pinehaven, the nights had not seemed romantic as she remembered them from when she'd been growing up here. At best, the falling darkness brought with it an air of strangeness, of an alien realm, as if nature knew of her years in the city, thought her a traitor to the land, and no longer welcomed her. At worst, the night sometimes seemed full of menace, for the world had deteriorated since her childhood, even here in Pinehaven County. It was easy to imagine a nightmare gallery of decadence, meth lab operators and half-crazed end-times loners, who had taken refuge deep in the wilderness and might at night venture nearer to watch her from the trees. For the first few months after they moved in, she closed all the draperies and blinds with the setting of the sun. but the locals welcomed them at once, and in time the land seemed as benign as it had been in her youth. These days Megan no longer suspected the forest of harboring a nasty work of degenerates, and nightfall brought with it only stars and the moon either in full or fragment. For some, the loneliness of widowhood would have been magnified by the solitude of this property, by sharing it only with a boy who never spoke. For Megan, solitude allowed contemplation and introspection, which led to acceptance of her loss, and peace came upon her sooner here than it might have elsewhere. She finished a chapter in her book and the wine in her glass, closed the former and rinsed out the latter at the sink. She went through the downstairs, double-checking door locks and turning out the lights in her wake. In the foyer, at the living room archway, as she reached for the wall switch, she saw that Woody had been here before going to his room. The silver-framed photographs were no longer face down on the Steinway. They were all facing the piano bench, so she could see them when she played. But they should be turned in this direction, toward the room. She would rearrange them in the morning. Right now it was enough to know that he had heard her earlier, understood what she told him about keeping his father in their memory, and agreed. She doused the living room lights. At the front door, the deadbolt was engaged. On the security system keypad, a red light glowed under the word HOME, just as it did on the control unit by the back door. A third keypad was in the master bedroom. With her book in hand, intending to read herself to sleep, Megan climbed the stairs. The wind was a testing wind that rattled sheet tin somewhere above, perhaps the flange on a chimney spark arrester, whistled along empty rain gutters, pillowed its fists against window glass, pressed creaks and muffled groans from attic rafters, collar beams, and joists much as a rolling sea made the timbers of a ship's hull speak. After rapping softly on Woody's door, she opened it. In the light of a nightstand lamp, he was sound asleep, half sitting up against a rampart of pillows, an open hardcover book splayed on his lap. She plucked a Kleenex from the box on his nightstand, used it to mark his place in the story, and set the book aside. She took two pillows from the stack against which the boy leaned, eased him into a better sleeping posture, and pulled up the blanket. Although Woody seldom slept more than 5 or 6 hours, he was a deep sleeper. Megan's ministrations failed to wake him. She kissed his smooth, cool brow and adjusted the three-way lamp to its lowest setting. As she stepped away from the bed, the boy muttered in his sleep. She turned to study him and listened and decided that his dream, whatever its subject might be, was not a nightmare. He didn't seem to be distressed. She was almost to the door when she thought she heard a word escape him, not the meaningless murmurs and whimpers of a dreamer, but in fact, a word. His first in all his life. For perhaps a minute she stood rock still, listening. But if he had spoken, he did not speak again. Indeed, the muttering and murmuring had ceased. He lay in silence. She must have heard something in this dreamy ramble that hadn't been there. After all, neither he nor she knew anyone named Dorothy. Chapter 46. The guest bedroom at the end of the upstairs hallway lies in darkness, the door ajar. Shacket watches the bitch through the gap as she raps lightly on the door to the boys' room and then goes in there. When she appears maybe 2 minutes later, she comes toward him, unaware that she is observed and desired. She switches off the hall light and enters the master bedroom. That door has no deadbolt, only a flimsy privacy latch engaged by a button in the knob. Most likely, she won't even use that. The perimeter of the security system is armed, the doors and windows. She feels that she is in no danger. Earlier, while she and the boy ate dinner, Shacket returned to her bedroom, suddenly wondering about the possibility of a gun. A woman alone was likely to have a weapon. He found the gun safe attached to the bed rail, which he had previously overlooked. To open it, he required a 4-digit number. He knew several important things about Megan, and one of them was likely to provide what he needed. When programming such devices, people tended to resort to a sequence of numbers they weren't likely to forget. He knew her birthday, Jason's birthday, Woody's birthday, and the date of her wedding, at which he had been a guest, but not, of course, the best man. He had tried the numbers in that order. The wedding date did the trick. The 10 bullets are now in the toilet bowl in the spare bedroom bath, waiting to be flushed. He leaves the guest room and makes his way along the hall to the master suite. He puts one ear to the door, listens, and hears running water. When he turns the knob, the privacy latch is not engaged. He opens the door several inches. Both bedside lamps are aglow. The door to the bathroom stands half open. He can't see Megan, but he can hear the buzz of an electric toothbrush. On the bed is a book. Apparently she intends to read for a while. If he is to fulfill his fantasy of settling atop her when she is asleep, entering her as she wakes, he needs to give her a couple of hours before he returns. He closes the door quietly and makes his way down through the lightless house, which is not dark to him. Chapter 47. In her first few months in this house, when the Sierra night seemed to harbor imminent existential threats, Megan lay awake, in anticipation of shattering glass and the piercing shrillness of the alarm. Because she slept in a t-shirt and panties, before retiring each evening, she laid out a pair of jeans and a crewneck sweater on the other half of the king-size bed, where she could quickly snatch them up and slip into them. 3 years later, though now she found her initial paranoia amusing, she remained in the habit of having clothes near at hand. After placing the jeans and sweater like the form of an imaginary bedmate, she went around to her side of the bed, turned back the top sheet with the blanket, and discovered a 3-inch-long smear of some kind on the bottom sheet. This was Wednesday, and Verna Brickett routinely changed the linens midweek, so they ought to be spotless. Megan wiped a finger across the substance and brought it to her nose. It smelled like earth, dirt. A few small flecks of chaff were in it, bits of golden grass or weeds. She couldn't imagine how this had gotten here, or why Verna hadn't noticed it. Nearly all of it brushed off with the sweep of her hand. She returned to the bathroom to get a fresh washcloth, dampened a corner, and used that to remove the last traces of dirt without leaving a significant wet spot. After washing her hands, as she settled in bed to read, her back against the padded headboard, she smelled something alien to herself and to the room. A thin, acrid odor. She turned her head left, right, leaned forward to smell the blanket, but the strange scent had been faint and transient. She could no longer detect it. She picked up her book and opened it. Chapter 48. As restless as the wind that chases its many tails through the night, Lee Shackett wanders the dark rooms of the ground floor of the house. He is frustrated, not merely by the need to wait for Megan to fall asleep, but also by the slow pace of his becoming. When this horizontal gene transfer is complete, he will be a more formidable man than he is now, above all men and all laws, including the laws of nature, and he is eager, impatient, to fulfill his singular destiny. He intuits that the programmed archaea will effect further changes, rendering him powerful beyond all human dreams of power. But he lacks the imagination to foresee what his new strengths and capabilities will be. He wants them now. As the wind combs dead needles from the pines and slings them through the night to prickle like sleet against the living room windows, Shackett circles the grand piano, the very presence of which angers him for some reason that he can't define. She won't play the damn thing when she is his collared and obedient bitch. She will not be allowed music or painting. She will be allowed only to submit, to service him in all the ways he likes, and she will enjoy it. The 10 empty silver frames stand testament to a past that he will erase, to a husband and son who will be purged from her memory, so that her life will begin tonight, under him. He feels the folded photos in the pocket of his jeans, and realizes that his previous intention to wad them and shove them down her throat to punish her for resistance is not necessary. There will be no significant resistance. By the hour, he grows stronger. He is aware of an increasing density of his muscles and a previously unknown tensile strength. He will easily be able to pin her beneath him. At the least provocation, he will bite off one of her ears and chew it and spit it in her face, terrifying her into submission without materially damaging her beauty, which she must retain to be worthy of him. She must as well remain worthy of being the mother of the new race, for she will bear many offspring. Children who will be formed in Shackett's image, blessed with his superior genes. They won't be merely children, but demigods, incorporating the diverse attributes of many species. He no longer has any doubt that he will pass along what the billions, trillions of Archaea have installed within him. His testicles feel swollen with the seed of a new world. From his pocket he extracts the photographs. They slip from his fingers. He tramples them underfoot as he leaves the room. His metamorphizing vision amplifies the most meager sources of light, so that he navigates the rooms and hallways with increasing agitation, but without knocking against anything, as silent as a silver fish that has slithered out of a crack in the baseboard to explore in the darkness that it prefers. In spite of the wondrous nature of his becoming, or because of it, he cannot sit and wait. He fidgets even as he moves from one place to another, wringing his hands and running them through his hair, plucking at the spots on his t-shirt that are crusted with Justine's blood, sucking at his teeth for a remaining taste of her. He finds himself in Megan's art studio, standing in a window, with no memory of having come here. Tall, slender yard trees are bent severely toward the southeast, as though the very rotation of Earth is so violently accelerated that all things rooted in its crust will be torn loose and sent tumbling. The wind's ferocity excites Shacket, calls for him to break things as it shatters fragile limbs, to tear things as it shreds leaves and sends them swarming through the night like colonies of deformed bats. Then he's on the move again, through a bizarre architecture, as if the house is transforming in sympathy with him. Hallways are now tunnels, although not carved out of earth or rock, but rather shaped by legions from some secreted organic material resembling coarse paper. The windowless rooms, roughly rounded like chambers in an enclosed nest. As strange as it is, he nonetheless feels he belongs here, and he is drawn toward some communion with a horde of his own kind. But that proves to be a hallucination, or a memory born not of experience but of instinct, because then he finds himself in the kitchen, hungrier than he has ever been. He puts his pistol on the table and searches through the contents of the freezer drawer in the bottom of the refrigerator. He finds 4 steaks, filet mignon, in sealed packets bearing the name of a high-end mail-order purveyor of meats. He tears open one package and chews on the raw product, but it is frozen and doesn't satisfy. Not bothering with a dish, he places the steak in the microwave and presses the control labeled defrost, and stands looking through the oven window while the carousel turns in the bath of radiation. As the filet begins to weep a watery serum tinted with blood, Shacket hears himself making a thin keening sound, similar to one of the many voices of the wind. Taken from the microwave, the meat is cool but no longer icy, malleable in his eager hands, wet and tender between his teeth. The taste does not offend, the texture is not repulsive, but it also is not what he hoped it would be, what he needs. The limp mass of beef doesn't struggle in his hands, nor does it cry out as it is torn, nor does it satisfy as did Justine in the meadow grass. He wanders the house again, window to window, coveting the wind and the dark, wanting to be out there in the tumult, which speaks to him, excites him. His heart races, his pulse pounds in his temples. He finds himself in the kitchen again, staring at the steaks that are defrosting on the floor. He finds himself at the front door, staring at the word under the tiny red indicator light. Home. He turns away from the keypad, from the door. He ascends the stairs. In the upstairs hall, following the Persian runner, he arrives at the master suite. A blade of light slices through the quarter inch between the door and mahogany floor. The bitch is still awake, reading. He wants to take her while she sleeps. While she sleeps. He stands there for a while, staring down at the light that shines like a razor's edge, his thoughts urgent and lustful and chaotic. With one hand he rubs the crotch of his jeans. His other hand pulls at his face, as though it's a mask he feels compelled to strip off, clamps over his trembling mouth to repress a cry that he yearns to let out. The wind that harrows the night encourages him to join it in a rampage, and multiple hungers besiege him. He turns from her suite and retreats toward the front stairs. He halts at the door to the boy's room, where only a strip of pale light pearls on the polished mahogany floor. If any sound rises from within, it is too faint to be heard above the wind. Change of plans. The boy first. Shacket opens the door. He steps inside. He quietly closes the door behind him. Chapter 49. The Four Square Diner stood directly across the town square park from the Pinehaven County Courthouse, Sheriff's Department HQ, and morgue. At peak business hours, the melange of aromas could make anyone on a strict diet weep, but at this late hour, the air was redolent of only bacon and coffee. A sheriff's deputy, Bern Holland, was on duty from 8 p.m. until 5 a.m., and therefore ate according to a contrarian schedule, sat at the counter, having a lunch of bacon and egg sandwiches with fries. The other two men at the counter were here for the coffee. Carson Conroy sat in a window booth with black coffee and a wide slice of raisin and plum pie. By the time he'd finished the autopsies of Payton Spader and Justine Kleinman, the dinner hour had long since come and gone, as had his appetite. Over the years, the condition of people killed in accidents or murdered had ceased to sicken him, or to have any effect on him other than sometimes to elicit pity. The morgue was a world of the dead, who were beyond help and hope, as segregated from the world of the living as any dream was separate from reality. When he left work, he did so as if arising from a sleeper's phantasms, and in his busy after-work life, Carson usually didn't dwell on what he'd seen on the autopsy table, any more than he would repeatedly rerun a dream in memory after waking from it. Usually. But this one was far from an ordinary case. He had no appetite for his long-delayed dinner, certainly not for meat of any kind, or for anything savory, only for coffee and the sweetness of fruit pie. With the wind gibbering and howling past the windows, and the park trees shaking their shaggy shadows in the frosty light of the tall lampposts, Halloween seemed to have come 6 weeks early, when a van-type morgue wagon, a converted ambulance with roof-mounted light bar, cruised past the diner, bearing on its door the seal of the Attorney General's Office of the State of California. The sip of coffee Carson was just then taking seemed to go from hot to cold in an instant. The vehicle could not have been more ominous if it had been a long black Cadillac with tinted windows and a license plate that bore 7 zeros. A chill stepped down his spine, for he knew intuitively that this had something to do with the two corpses in the morgue's cold-holding drawers. Sacramento, the state capital, was 2 hours away, but the trip could have been made faster if they used their light bar and siren. Although some show windows glowed warmly, the shops around the square were closed, and no one was afoot at this moment. The morgue wagon slowed at the north end of the square, turned left, slowed further, and turned left again, no doubt bound for the county buildings on the west side of the park. That narrow greensward, about 80 feet wide, featured a three-tiered central bowl fountain and a few benches. 7 pines graced the park, all of them so old that their lowest branches were above an average man's head. Carson had a clear view of the Attorney General's vehicle as it braked to a stop, hesitated, and then turned right into the service alley between the sheriff's headquarters and the morgue, its headlights washing the brick walls of the buildings. Leaving his pie and coffee unfinished, Carson put enough money on the table to cover the check and the tip. On his way out, he told the young waitress, Angela, that he was wanted in the zombie vault, which was what she insisted on calling the morgue. Although summer officially still had another week to rule the mountains, the chilly wind previewed the autumn, scented with pine and the filtered wood smoke that issued from fireplace chimneys. It buffeted Carson, forced him to tuck his head down and squint against the thread of the dead pine needles and fine grit that it carried in its currents. He crossed the street, the park, the street again, and entered the alleyway as the Van Hurst turned right and out of sight into the municipal parking lot behind the morgue. As he was approaching the side entrance to the sheriff's headquarters, the door opened, and Sheriff Hayden Ekman stepped into the alleyway, his face ghastly white in the fall of light from the security lamp directly over his head. Ekman appeared not merely surprised to encounter Carson, but unsettled. The office of county sheriff was an elected position, however, and being a consummate politician, Ekman instantly converted his startlement into a smile that seemed to say, "Ah, what a relief to have you here."
"Carson? I thought you were home in bed. I'd have called, but you've had such a long day, I didn't want to bother you."
Hours earlier in the evening, Carson had met with the sheriff in the morgue to go over the results of the autopsies. They agreed to delay a press announcement until the families of the deceased could be found and notified, and until the department's community relations officer had time to craft a statement that conveyed the facts of the murders without using language that would unduly alarm the public. Considering the extreme violence and the cannibalism, Carson thought the public ought to be unduly alarmed. But his position was not elected, and having come from a city in which political power mattered more than any force in society, he knew the folly of asserting the full truth of anything when those who had ascended through the ballot box preferred to support a version of the truth made more palatable to the voters. Now, as the blustering wind rattled an empty beer can along the alleyway, Carson said, "What's happening?"
"Damnedest thing," said Hayden Ekman. "Come with me, you'll see."
He hurried along the alley to the municipal parking lot, into which the morgue wagon from Sacramento had disappeared. Chapter 50. In the strange dream, Woody and some old woman named Dorothy were riding in the back seat of a car, and a younger woman whom Dorothy called Rosa was driving, and they came upon this hitchhiker by the side of the road, a tall and strong-looking guy. Woody knew that it was very unwise to pick up a hitchhiker, especially one who was a tall, strong-looking guy, but Rosa stopped for him nonetheless. When he got into the car, Rosa said, "We need protection from Frank the Hater. He's going to put us in cages and never let us out." The man smiled, yet a very appealing smile, and said, "I've dealt with Frank the Hater before. Don't you worry about him." From outside the car came the sound of wind, although there hadn't been wind before, and Woody felt it in his face, though all the windows remained closed. Then the tall, strong man looked into the back seat and winked at Woody and said, "How are you doing, Scooby-Doo?" Rosa pulled the car onto the highway again, and the wind in Woody's face increased, blowing on his eyelids and lashes, and Dorothy said to the man, "My sweet boy is just fine now that you're here," and she put an arm around Woody. Although he didn't mind being touched by nice people, Woody was surprised when he licked Dorothy's hand. The wind made him blink, 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 and when he opened his eyes, he found himself lying in bed on his left side. A man was kneeling next to the bed, clearly visible in the low light of the lamp, leaning close and blowing on Woody's face. For a moment, Woody felt disoriented, wondering what happened to the car and everyone in it. And then he realized he'd been dreaming. For another moment, he thought he might still be dreaming as the kneeling man stopped blowing and smiled at him. And then he caught the scent of the intruder, the subtle odor that he couldn't describe, that he'd experienced a few times before, the scent that maybe smelled stronger to dogs, like they said in those articles he'd read. This man smelled scary. Worse than scary. What was worse? Evil? Fears paralyzed Woody, so he couldn't even lift his head from the pillow. The stranger spoke softly. "Hey, little dude, what'd he say?" Woody said nothing. "Cat got your tongue?" Their faces were maybe 6 or 8 inches apart. The man's left eye was gray, his right eye brown, as if he wore colored contacts and one of them had fallen out. Something was odd about the left eye, a soft glow deep in it. "You hear me, Woodrow?" the stranger whispered. "Are you mute and deaf, you little freak?" Chapter 51. The ice-white fluorescent radiance in the cold-holding room fell on bone-white ceramic tile walls and floor, on the stainless steel fronts of 2 banks of cadaver drawers, 4 above and 4 below, on Carson Conroy and Sheriff Hayden Ekman, and on the 2 men from Sacramento. The hard light made no one look young or handsome or kind. Of the men from the state capital, the one named Frawley was supposed to be an assistant medical examiner. Even at this hour of the night, he wore a well-tailored suit, white shirt, and silk tie. His wingtips looked English, maybe by Crockett and Jones, which meant they probably cost $600 or $700, and he sported a gold Rolex watch. The other guy, Zellman, was a blocky individual with a face like one you might find frowning eternally in a deep jungle temple, carved from stone by worshippers and meant to represent a god of the wrathful variety. thick neck, long arms, enormous hands. He claimed to be a morgue attendant and driver. Carson didn't believe either man was what he presented himself to be. Frawley looked like a fixer, a slick operator who had friends in all the highest places and knew how to take care of any screw-up they committed. Zellman had to be muscle, plain and simple. They were here to take possession of the bodies of Peyton Spader and Justine Kleinman, which were zippered tight in cadaver bags and snugged in two of the stainless steel drawers.
"We'll remove them to the morgue in Sacramento," said Frawley.
"I don't understand this," Carson said.
"We're asserting jurisdiction. Sheriff Ekman has agreed to relinquish investigative authority to the state."
To Carson, Hayden Ekman said,
"The AG called me himself a few hours ago. He made a persuasive argument."
"What argument?" Frawley turned to an attaché case that lay on a gurney employed to move cadavers through the morgue. Opening the case and extracting a sheaf of papers, he said,
"One of Sheriff Ekman's men found the killer's wallet near Justine Kleinman's body. It must have fallen out of his pants when he was savaging her. ID in the wallet is for Nathan Palmer, who's a fugitive wanted for murder." "When we had the ID," Hayden Ekman told Carson, "we went to the National Crime Information Center website to see if there was any posting for this guy. There was. State and federal authorities are after him big time."
"When did this happen?"
"Earlier this evening." "While I was doing the autopsies?" "You and Jim had just started the first one."
Jim Harmon was Carson's one assistant.
"And you didn't tell me?"
Ekman didn't meet Carson's eyes, but instead stared at the papers Frawley had produced.
"The want on this Nathan Palmer creep is intense. It's not something to dick around with. I've been on the phone working things out with the Attorney General and the FBI for hours. We have a good lab here, but nothing like the state and feds can provide in Sacramento."
He stepped to the gurney and began to sign the documents where they were marked with brightly colored stick-on plastic arrows. For the past 9 months, Carson had been trying with some difficulty to get a fix on Hayden Ekman. It wasn't the sheriff who'd brought him to Pinehaven County 4 years earlier. Ekman was a competent lawman and department manager, but more political than his predecessor, perhaps with one eye on a higher elected office.
"He urinated on the bodies, on their clothes," Carson said.
Frawley looked at him as if to say,
"And your point is?"
"I have the clothes, other evidence. We'll find a few hairs of his, other DNA. Everything's ready for the lab in the morning." Frawley nodded.
"We'll take all that with us tonight. Our lab operates 24/7.
He presented a new document. He said to the sheriff, "Signature there, initial here."
"But what about finding him?" "It's inevitable, Mr. Conroy."
"You seem very laid back about this. Palmer bit the woman to death. He ate her face, her breasts, for Christ's sake."
"Nothing's to be gained by panicking the public," Frawley said.
"Leaving them ignorant is leaving them vulnerable."
"We release sensational details like that, we'll get hundreds of call-in tips, people citing Palmer everywhere he isn't. We'll have to investigate them when we should be tracking him down."
Carson said, "Sheriff, if this lunatic son of a bitch is loose in Pinehaven County—"
"His pattern," Frawley said with a note of condescension, "is to keep moving. Especially after a kill like this, there's virtually zero chance he's anywhere within 100 miles of here."
"Virtually is good enough for you? And since when do bug shit crazy and patterns of behavior go together?" Finished signing, Sheriff Ekman finally looked at Carson.
"Just in case Palmer is still in these parts, the state AG is lending us manpower for the search. We're a small department and cover a lot of ground, Carson. For a case like this, we need that help."
Producing a second set of documents, Frawley said, "Mr. Conroy, I need you to sign cadaver and evidence releases plus an NDA." "A non-disclosure agreement for a medical examiner? I've never heard of such a thing. If I have to testify in court—"
"You won't. You're out of this when you sign. It's not a murder case, Conroy. It's a matter of national security. Palmer may be a monster, but in court he has the right to call as witness anyone whose name is in the chain of evidence file. Not this guy. Not this case. Different rules apply," Frawley declared.
He cited federal statutes allowing Carson to be prosecuted for failure to cooperate. Whether they were real laws or fabricated, Carson didn't know. However, for years the country had seemed to be morphing from a representative republic into something worse. Throughout this, Stone faced Zelman and never taken his eyes off Carson, as though he was prepared to break a knee whenever that might be required.
"Sign it," Sheriff Ekman said, the coldness of angry authority in his voice. "It's late. It's the right thing to do. Sign it."
Strictly speaking, Hayden Ekman wasn't Carson's boss, but he had considerable influence with the county board. There was no doubt that he could get Carson fired for cause, and ensure that no other jurisdiction in need of a medical examiner would hire him. Affronted, Carson signed where the brightly colored stick-on arrows indicated, although he said, "I consider this under duress."
"Consider it what you wish," Frawley replied,
as he returned the documents to his attaché case. Chapter 52. The skirling wind whipping the night. The low lamplight. Gray eye, brown eye, the gray one somehow wrong. The stranger's breath smelled mega bad. His teeth were stained. Ragged tissue peeled from his chapped lips as if he'd been chewing on them. With one finger, the guy stroked Woody's right cheek, the side of his nose, and it was like being touched by something that had slithered out of the closet or from under the bed in a scary story, so that his hammering heart felt as if it might be rising into his throat, and he wanted to scream and scream. But he couldn't make a sound, nor could he move, only lie paralyzed with fear and gaze into the intruder's fierce eyes and smell his stinky breath, and wonder, what next? What next?
"You look just like your treacherous father," the stranger whispered. "Good thing you don't have a brain. The world doesn't need another scheming, selfish piece of shit like Jason."
"This must be someone from the dark web, from the tragedy site. Who else could it be? But how fast they tracked down their quarry. He should have left the computer unplugged."
"Are you really a dummy? You don't look like a dummy. Maybe you fake being a dummy."
With his finger, the man drew circles on the ball of Woody's chin, around and around.
"In the world becoming, there won't be any room for dummies. Not for dummies and cripples and people with wrong ideas."
He slid his finger over Woody's lower lip, the upper, the lower again, and Woody wanted to bite him hard.
"Very tender," the intruder said.
Rapidly, repeatedly, the man blinked his right eye, and the colored contact lens popped out. It stuck on his lower lash. With his thumb and forefinger, he plucked it up and stared at it, as though puzzled, as though he had no idea what it might be. He flicked it away. Now both eyes were gray, and both were wrong. When the man focused on Woody again, there seemed to be a radiance in his eyes that wasn't a reflection of the lamplight. The eyes were pools of gray, like rainwater puddled on weathered wood, and the pools were deep and cold, and from far down in them emanated a phosphorus glow. Woody desperately wanted to go away to Castle Wyvern, climb the tower stairs, shoot home the massive lock bolts, and curl up on the bed of reeds until this man wasn't here anymore. He wanted to look up at the glassless windows and watch the dragons flying across a sky thick with dark clouds through which lightning pulsed, but from which thunder never issued. If he fled to Wyvern, however, he would be leaving his mother alone with this man, this thing. Chapter 53. A few minutes past midnight, Megan closed the novel and put it on the nightstand. She was about to switch off the lamps when she realized that she hadn't gotten her pistol from the gun safe that was attached to the rail of the bed frame. She slid out of bed and knelt and entered the four digits of her wedding date. The door of the small metal box clicked open, and she retrieved the 9mm Heckler & Koch, and went suddenly, absolutely, still. Always she stowed the pistol with the muzzle toward the wall, toward the head of the bed. That was how the box was designed. The safe could accommodate the weapon in either position, but it was specifically designed for the grip to be toward the foot of the bed. Now the gun was reversed. Never before had she locked the pistol away in this position.
Verna Brickett didn't have the combination. Only Megan could open the gun safe.
The weapon didn't feel right either. Fear fine-tuned her senses, so that she could hear distinctly every instrument of the wind's symphonic performance and every response of the house. see her ghostly reflection in the farthest window, and the dark lashing yard trees, and the darker woods that should have been beyond her ken. Feel every subtle current of air that breathed across her bare legs, and also feel a lightness to the gun. She practiced at a shooting range monthly, often 200 rounds in a session, and she knew what the heckler felt like when it was fully loaded. She released the magazine. Empty. The pistol had held 10 rounds when she put it away the previous morning. Someone had come into the house before the alarm had been activated for the evening. Someone was still here. But who? Although she felt naked in her sleepwear, she went first to the walk-in closet. As she turned the knob, she realized that she hadn't entered the closet when she'd come to bed, as she thought. He's in there. That was an irrational thought, and she knew it for what it was, fear-born. And indeed, no one lurked in the closet. She turned on the light. The metal canister was stored at the back of a deep drawer, filled with running shorts and sweatpants. She retrieved it, screwed off the lid, took out a box of gold dot ammunition, opened both ends of the box, pressed out an egg crate plastic container in which were nestled 20 bullets, and hurried back to the bed. Hands trembling, she fumbled bullets out of the container and dropped 3 on the carpet. She told herself to get a grip. Shape up. She thought, Woody. Nothing can happen to Woody, please God. Her hands steadied, though inserting the rounds in the magazine wasn't as easy under these circumstances as on a shooting range. Come on, Megan, load the damn thing. All 10 rounds. Might need every one. When it was done, she glanced at the phone on the nightstand. The numbers for fire and police and ambulance were printed on a community-supplied card adhered to the cradle, between the handset and the keypad. No, Woody first. Sheriff's deputy would take 5 minutes, maybe 10, to get here. No time to pull on the jeans she'd laid out either. Straight to Woody, bring him back here, lock the door, brace it with a chair, call the police, then slip into the jeans and the crew neck. She went to the hallway door, grabbed the knob with her left hand, holding the pistol with her right. She couldn't do this and keep a preferred 2-hand grip on the gun. Doors were the worst, no way to know what waited beyond one. If an intruder stood ready on the other side, if he rushed her as she pulled open the door, he could unbalance her, strike her, tear the gun out of her hand. Except he thought the gun was unloaded, not a threat. So even if he knocked her off her feet, she still had her own advantage of surprise. Maybe it shouldn't have taken her this long to understand, but she only now realized that he hadn't come in her room and somehow opened the gun safe and unloaded the heckler if his intention was to burglarize the house without risk to himself. He had disarmed her and bided his time, hiding somewhere in the residence, waiting for her to go to sleep so that he could easily overwhelm her and rape her. Her heart knocked violently against its caging ribs as she opened the door to the hall. Chapter 54 Kip erupted from a dream about riding in a car with Dorothy and Rosa. The boy was screaming on the wire. He was a boy, no doubt about that now. Not another dog, but a special boy who could use the wire, whether he knew it or not, a boy like no other. And he was in peril. Springing to his feet on the bed, Kip barked twice. Startled, Ben Hawkins switched on a nightstand lamp and sat up, blinking away a residue of sleep.
Hey, what?
Kip jumped down from the bed and padded to the motel room door and reared up on his hind legs and pawed at the deadbolt. But that wasn't good enough. He seemed to be saying that he needed to potty. He didn't need to potty. He dashed to the nightstand, where Ben had left his wallet and the electronic key for the Range Rover. He stood on his hind legs again, bit the keychain, and hurried back to the door with the key dangling from his mouth. Getting out of bed, Ben said,
"What's gotten into you?"
Not having an alphabet wall and a laser pointer made life a lot more difficult. Kip dropped the key at the door. He hurried to the small table by the window, stood again, and got his mouth on the hardcover book Ben had been reading. He took the book to the door. He dropped it beside the key. He turned to look at his new companion.
You don't like the motel? You want one with more amenities? Listen, Scooby-Doo, I've only gotten like an hour of sleep.
On the wire, the boy was screaming in abject terror. Ben had brought a shaving kit in from the Range Rover. It was in the bathroom. He would have to pack that himself. He had also brought in a suitcase, but he had not yet opened it. The suitcase stood near the mirrored closet door. Panting with frustration, Kip went to the bag and knocked it over. He looked at his companion. Ben had hung his jeans in the closet. As he took them out and pulled them on, he said, "All right, what are you trying to tell me? That you need to pee?" He'd been a Navy SEAL. He couldn't be stupid. Maybe he just woke up slowly. Kip took the handle of the overturned suitcase in his mouth and, backing up, dragged the Samsonite across the room to the door. Sitting on the edge of the bed, pulling on the socks he'd left balled up in his sneakers, Ben said, "You're a very strange dog." The motel key was lying on the table where the book had been. Kip got it, brought it to the door, and dropped it on the suitcase. "Weird things happen in a war zone. There are times you ought to die, you don't, and it's impossible to explain why you don't." After putting on his shoes without further comment, Ben came to the door and stood looking at the suitcase, the book, the keys. "Like you turn a corner, there's a bad guy with an automatic carbine 10 feet away. He pulls the trigger, the rifle jams, and you shoot him dead instead of you." Kip wagged his tail.